Ads heard during the podcast that are not in my voice are placed by third-party agencies outside of my control and should not imply an endorsement by Weird Darkness or myself.
Stories and content in Weird Darkness can be disturbing for some listeners and is intended for mature audiences only. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
Lucifer, Satan, Beelzebub. These are but some of the many names used to describe the arch-demonic enemy of mankind. A diabolical devil figure appears in history all across the globe. Whether you believe in his existence or not, the hellish mark which the devil has left on the legends and folklores of mankind is indisputable. Many tales describe encounters with the beast, and tonight I have a few historic encounters with the devil. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Welcome, Weirdos! I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness Radio, where every week you'll find stories of the paranormal, supernatural, legends, lore, the strange and bizarre, crime, conspiracy, mysterious, macabre, unsolved, and unexplained. Coming up this hour, many tales describe encounters with the devil himself, yet not all are the same. Sometimes Satan approaches his prey, other times the lost soul goes seeking Lucifer to make a deal. Either way, the results are never favorable. If you're new here, welcome to the show. And if you're already a member of this weirdo family, please take a moment and invite someone else to listen in with you. Recommending Weird Darkness to others helps make it possible for me to keep doing the show. And while you're listening, be sure to visit WeirdDarkness.com and click on Contact Social to follow Weird Darkness on social media. And also on the website, you can find the daily Weird Darkness podcast, which comes out 7 days per week, along with my other podcasts like Retro Radio, Old Time Radio in the Dark, Church of the Undead, and a classic 1950s sci-fi style podcast called Auditory Anthology. You can enter contests, find Weird Darkness merchandise, and more. You can even send in your own true story of something paranormal that has happened to you or someone you know. You can find all of that at WeirdDarkness.com. Now, bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and come with me into the Weird Darkness. Richard Cabell lived during the 1600s and was the local squire of Brook Manor in Devon, England. He was regarded as a monstrously evil man, a figure of darkness who local legend records as having beaten and abused his wife, until one night she escaped, fleeing across the moors with her husband in hot pursuit. It is said that he eventually caught up with the unfortunate woman, murdering her and her faithful dog. The ghost of this loyal canine haunted Cabell for the rest of his life. The reason for the squire's darkness, it was said, lay in a deal he had made with the devil. Granted immortality by the beast, Cabell did as he pleased, creating such an infamous legacy that he would later go on to provide the inspiration for Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Hound of the Baskervilles. However, eternal life was not to be his. Cabell died on the 5th of July, 1677, with some saying that he was hunted to death by a pack of phantom hounds bent on revenge. On the night of his interment into the family tomb, it is said that this same pack of phantom hounds came baying across the moor to howl at his grave. From then on the anniversary of his death, the hellish phantom of Richard Cabell could be seen stalking the moors and the area around his final resting place. Terrified of the dark figure and his diabolical connection, local people built iron bars around the squire's tomb and placed a huge slab of stone on top of the grave. However, even after taking such precautions, some still report a strange red glow emanating through the iron bars. Some even claim that on certain nights, a whole host of demonic creatures gather at his grave, trying to retrieve the promised soul for their master. Saint Dunstan. In the 10th century, the religious fate of England was safeguarded by Saint Dunstan, a pious and charitable clergyman who held many important ecclesiastical positions throughout his life. By the time of his death in 988, Dunstan had served as the Archbishop of Canterbury and had reformed monastic life in England, as well as being a skilled artist, harpist, and metalsmith. Not only that, it was said that Dunstan had protected England from the devil himself. According to legend, Dunstan encountered the devil numerous times. The most famous of these encounters occurred whilst he was living as a hermit in a cell at Glastonbury. A talented metalsmith as he was, Dunstan occasionally accepted commissions. One such commission came from an old man who appeared at his window, asking if Dunstan would make a chalice for him. Agreeing, Dunstan began work on the piece. However, when he looked up from his work, he noticed that his visitor had changed. One moment he was the old man, the next a young boy, then a woman. It was then that Dunstan realized his visitor was the devil. Concealing his distress, Dunstan continued to craft the chalice. He picked up his blacksmith's tongs and moved them to the fire. Once they were red hot, he pulled them from the flames, turned on his heel, and seized the devil by the nose with the tongs. Despite the struggling and screams of the devil, Dunstan calmly cast the beast from his cell. On another occasion, Dunstan was sat in his cell playing his harp. As the saint sang his melodious tune, a tramping vagrant approached. This was the devil, once again intent on deceiving the holy man. However, Dunstan was a man of cunning. He once again seized the devil, this time grabbing his diabolic hoof. The saint proceeded to shoo the beast, furiously nailing a metal horseshoe to the devil's hoof. The devil pleaded and cried in pain as Dunstan hammered nail after nail into him. When he was done, Dunstan only agreed to remove the shoe and free the devil after he promised he would never pass through a door over which a horseshoe hangs. And from then on, the hanging of a horseshoe outside one's home has been associated with good luck and protection. Over your threshold, on your mast, be sure the horseshoe's well nailed fast.
More diabolical dealings with the devil when Weird Darkness returns.
Welcome back to Weird Darkness. I'm Darren Marlar. You can get more Weird Darkness 7 days a week through the Weird Darkness podcast, which you can find wherever you listen to podcasts, on YouTube, or visit WeirdDarkness.com/listen and find a list of all the apps where you can listen to the show. That's WeirdDarkness.com/listen. We now continue with more stories of those who've dealt directly with the devil. Almost every country possesses a legend of a devil's bridge. In this respect, the Tyrol region of Austria is no different. Legend reports that one day, a village in the valley of Montafon had their bridge swept away by an overwhelming torrent. The villagers were justifiably concerned, for they depended upon that passage to pass to and from Schruns on the other side of the river, from where they traded and purchased their supplies. Banding together, the villagers applied to the local carpenter,
offering him a large sum of money if he would rebuild the vital bridge in 3 days' time. The carpenter was in disbelief. The money being offered would make his large family rich. However, he saw that completing such a great amount of work in just 3 days was an impossibility. Before making a decision, he begged the villagers for 1 day of reflection. All that day, up to midnight, the carpenter studied and pondered, frantically searching for a way to rebuild the bridge in a specified time. Angry and annoyed, he could find no solution. Just when he was about to give up and go to bed, a little man wearing a green hat entered the room. The strange man claimed that he could help the carpenter complete the task in the 3 days. He did, however, have one condition. Once the bridge was finished, the first soul out of the carpenter's house to pass over the bridge would belong to him. So enticed by the large sum of money was he, the carpenter agreed to the devil's terms, believing that when the time came, he could cheat the devil. 3 days afterwards, the bridge was complete, and the devil stood in the middle awaiting his prey. After having remained there for many days, the carpenter at last appeared. Sensing his payment was close at hand, the devil jumped with joy. However, the carpenter was driving one of his goats, and as he approached the bridge, he pushed her on before him and called out, "There you have the first soul out of my house." In a fit of rage at having been so deceived and humiliated, the devil seized the goat by the tail and dragged her across the bridge. So hard did the devil handle the creature, her tail came out. Laughed at and mocked by all who saw him with the goat, the devil took off. It is said that since the day the carpenter outsmarted the devil, all goats now have short tails. Robert Johnson. He was an American blues singer, songwriter, and musician. It was his guitar playing ability for which he is most remembered, and is still considered to be among the greatest guitarists of all time. Strangely, playing the guitar was not a skill which he was ever known for as a child. The story goes that, although he did play it avidly in high school, he was not reported as having any real talent for the guitar. However, at the age of 18, Johnson displayed a mastery of guitar that seemed to come from nowhere. His rapid knowledge of the instrument was inexplicable. He played it with such intimate finesse that the only explanation for it was devilry. According to legend, as a young man living on a plantation in rural Mississippi, Johnson greatly desired to become a great blues musician. The desire was so great, he took his guitar to a nearby crossroads. There, he was met by the devil, who took his guitar and retuned it. Upon handing it back, Johnson was given mastery of the instrument for the small price of his soul. In the years that followed, Johnson became an itinerant musician, moving from place to place, playing his guitar for tips on street corners. He later went on to record several songs. Some say that allusions to Johnson's diabolical pact can be found in several of his own songs, including Crossroad Blues and Me and the Devil. Somewhat ominously, Johnson died under mysterious circumstances in 1938 at the young age of 27. One theory suggests that he was poisoned by the jealous husband of a woman he had flirted with. Another theory is he died of syphilis. Ultimately, no one knows. Not only that, Johnson's gravesite is also a mystery, with at least three different locations having been marked out as possible sites. With Johnson's music now enshrined in the Blues Hall of Fame, one can only wonder if the devil came and collected his fee as agreed. After all, Johnson died at the legendary and possibly cursed age of 27, meaning that he joined other great musicians in that infamous 27 Club, including Jimi Hendrix, Kurt Cobain, and Jim Morrison. the possession of George Lukens. On Saturday, May 31, 1788, the Reverend Joseph Easterbrook was alerted to the strange case of George Lukens, a man who claimed to be possessed by the devil. It was one of the Reverend's parishioners, Mrs. Sarah Barber, who told him of Lukens' affliction. Upon visiting the village of Yatton in Somerset, a place where she used to live, Mrs. Barber had been disturbed to find a man she once knew in a state of extraordinary illness. George Lukens, a tailor and common carrier by profession, had been a child of good character who constantly attended the church and sacrament. However, for the last 18 years, his demeanor had shifted. His nature changed. During her stay in the village, she told the Reverend she witnessed the unfortunate man have fits multiple times a day, during which he sang and screamed in various sounds, some of which did not resemble a human voice. George had been placed under the care of Mr. Smith, an eminent surgeon. Many other medical gentlemen had also lent their help to Mr. Smith and his patient. All was in vain. No cure could be found for the mysterious malady, with George himself declaring, in the middle of his fits, that no doctor could do him service. Many of the people of the village were convinced the man was bewitched. George himself declared that he was possessed of seven devils. Upon hearing Mr. Barber's recollections, Reverend Easterbrook requested George Lukens visit him. In the Reverend's notes, he described how George made the most horrible noises as his body convulsed. Experiencing as many as 9 fits a day, the man was weak and emaciated. He was also unable to hear religious expressions without writhing in pain. Another witness who published a letter in the local newspaper at the time described how George would declare in a roaring voice that he is the devil, before singing a hunting song in a hoarse and frightful voice. They even detailed how, at certain periods of the fit, he was so violent that an assistant was always obliged to be at hand to restrain him from committing some injury to himself. On June 13th, Reverend Easterbrook and several of his friends and colleagues met with George in the vestry room of the church. They began by singing hymns, which immediately caused George to convulse in agitation. His fit became more violent until he spoke in deep, hoarse, hollow voice. The voice declared that it would never quit its hold of George, and that any attempt to help the man would cause him to suffer torment 1,000 times worse. The voice then started singing in its usual manner, boasting of its power, blaspheming and vowing vengeance on both the unfortunate George and all those who dared to oppose him. As the session continued, other voices manifested, all refusing to release George and warning against any and all attempts to help him. At one point, a voice possessed the man and declared, "I am the great devil," before causing George to have such violent convulsions that 2 men had to restrain him. When the voice thought to be the devil was asked why he tormented George, it answered, "that I may show my power amongst men." All the while, George continued to suffer violent convulsions, despite his small size and weakened body. As the session reached its climax, one of the clergymen commanded, "In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, the evil spirit depart from the man." Prayers for his deliverance were offered and the clergyman's command repeated. George's convulsions and agonies grew stronger. He was by now crying out, howling in miserable pain. Then he was delivered. The convulsions stopped. The devil seemingly departed. George Lukens, previously declared by medical men as incurable, was cured.
Up next, I've already shared 5 stories of those who've had dealings with the devil. Up next, I'll share a few cases for his existence when Weird Darkness returns. If you or someone you know struggles with depression or dark thoughts, I'd like to recommend the Hope in the Darkness page at WeirdDarkness.com. There, I've gathered numerous free resources to help you fight depression, including the 7 Cups app, the Suicide and Crisis Hotline, ifred.org, and many more. These resources are absolutely free, and they're there for you 24/7 whenever you need them. They're on the Hope in the Darkness page at WeirdDarkness.com. That's WeirdDarkness.com/hope. Whatever religion you follow or do not follow, the existence of an arch-demonic being in folklore across time, space, and culture is undeniable. The Devil's Bible, made from more than 160 animal skins and needing 2 people to lift it, Codex Gigas, also known as the Devil's Bible, was allegedly written in just 1 night. Hermann the Recluse was a 12th-century Bohemian monk. Legend has it that he was walled up inside of his cell, condemned to atone for his sins by inscribing holy texts for the rest of his days. To complete the great task more quickly and release himself from an early grave, the monk made a pact with the devil. With the devil's aid, the monk supposedly wrote the entire book in a single night. The first half of the tome comprises the entire Latin Vulgate Bible. The remainder is a bizarre mixture of ancient medical treatises, encyclopedias, chronicles, and magical formulas. The colossal codex even contains a portrait of Lucifer, purportedly drawn by the fallen angel himself. In experiments conducted to recreate the work, it has been estimated that reproducing the calligraphy alone, without the illustrations or embellishments, would have taken 5 years of non-stop writing. Most scholars believe that, working at a regular pace, it should have taken the monk around 30 years to compose the codex. However, academics have remarked at the stability of the handwriting found throughout the book, the suggestion being that the Devil's Bible must have been written over a very short period of time. The possession of Elizabeth Knapp. Born in Massachusetts around 1655, Elizabeth Knapp worked as a household servant for the local reverend. To all who met her, Elizabeth was nothing more than an ordinary young woman. That was until the devil came calling. It was when she was 16 years old that Elizabeth began to show signs of demonic possession. Samuel Willard, the reverend whom she served, documented the case in great detail. First, the girl experienced pains throughout her body. She would yell out, grabbing her leg, her breast, her neck. Often she would exclaim that she was being strangled. Elizabeth would suffer nighttime fits, reporting to have witnessed 2 persons walking around her as her body convulsed unnaturally. One day, Elizabeth confessed to the reverend that it was the devil himself who was stalking her. She claimed that he had promised her money, youth, ease from labor, and the ability to see the world. He had presented her with a book of blood covenants, which were signed by other women who had been unfortunate enough as to sign away their souls. However, Elizabeth exclaimed that she had been unable to do all that Satan had asked of her, namely to kill the Reverend Willard and his family. As winter approached, the possession escalated. During one of her violent fits, Elizabeth began talking in a strange, deep voice. Willard wrote in his journal how the girl's mouth remained closed as her throat swelled up. In his mind, the devil talked through her body. What makes this case particularly interesting is the detailed and scientific approach which the reverend employed. He called in medical doctors and learned men
on several occasions in order to try and find a cure for Elizabeth's symptoms. Possession by the devil was a conclusion only reached after all other options were exhausted. In one of his concluding journal entries, Willard stated that Knapp's temperament was unnatural and therefore diabolic. The Devil's Footprints. In February 1855, the people of Exestuary in Devon, England, awoke to discover the Devil's hoofprints trodden in the snow. The cloven-shaped marks covered a distance of some 40 to 100 miles. Houses, rivers, haystacks, and other obstacles were traversed straight over. The diabolical footprints even appeared on the tops of snow-laden roofs and high walls, as well as leading up to and exiting drain pipes. News of the unexplainable event reached as far as Australia. An extract from a newspaper there exclaimed in confusion that the footprints were to be seen in all kinds of unaccountable places. Investigators have commented that if the tracks really extended for close to 100 miles, no human being would have been able to follow their entire course in a single night. According to Truman's Exeter Flying Post, the case was an excitement worthy of the Dark Ages, and they published a piece on the foot tracks of a most strange and mysterious description. Others, however, thought little of the story's excitement and more of its infernal meaning. In the town of Dawlish, a group of tradesmen were so distressed that they armed themselves with guns and bludgeons. On the morning of the 9th of February, they took off in pursuit of the mysterious footprints. At the time, the bizarre theories were circulated in order to distract local parishioners' concerns about a visit from the devil. The local Reverend Musgrave explained the event away by blaming the footprints on a couple of escaped kangaroos from a private zoo. However, he later recanted in a letter addressed to a London newspaper. "I found a very apt opportunity to mention the name of kangaroo in allusion to the report then current. I certainly did not pin my faith to that version of the mystery, but the state of the public mind, the villagers, dreading to go out after sunset under the conviction that this was the devil's work, rendered it very desirable that a turn should be given to such a degraded and vited notion, and I was thankful that a kangaroo served to disperse ideas so derogatory." Until this day, nobody has been able to explain who or what visited the people of Exestuary that night. The Gateway to Hell in Hauska Castle in the Czech Republic. The castle was built with only one purpose – to encase the Gateway to Hell. But in the middle of nowhere, this imposing Gothic structure was constructed with no fortifications, no water, no kitchen. When it was completed in the 13th century, it had no occupants. Instead, the castle's fortified inwards, with its chapel built over a huge, bottomless pit acclaimed to be the entrance to hell. Its sole purpose is to keep the devil and his demons at bay. Historic witness reports attest to demonic half-animal, half-man creatures dragging themselves out from its depths. Other reports describe dark, winged creatures pouring out from the endless chasm in order to terrorize the local populace. According to local legend, when construction on the castle began, local prisoners who were sentenced to death were recruited to discover more about the mysterious hole. If they allowed themselves to be lowered by rope into the dark depths, they would receive a pardon. However, when the first of the inmates was lowered, he began screaming after just a few moments. Those holding the rope dragged him back to the surface. The man had wrinkles, his hair had turned white. In a few mere seconds, he had aged by over 30 years. The unfortunate man died of unknown causes only a few days afterwards. During the 1930s, the Nazis supposedly occupied the castle so as to conduct occult experiments with dimensional portals. Years later, during renovations, several Nazi officer skeletons were found there. In the modern day, the castle's ghostly as well as demonic residents are well known and have attracted many paranormal enthusiasts. Sightings include mysterious beasts, a headless black horse, and a distressed spectral woman. Beneath the cellar, it is claimed that there are non-human remains of the demons who've managed to claw their way out of hell. And then, there's the devil's handwriting itself. According to modern knowledge, there is only one specimen of satanic calligraphy in existence. This curious extract first appeared in 1523, taken from an Italian text which describes an encounter between Lodovico Spoletano and the devil. Spoletano allegedly summoned Satan, requesting that he use his body as a vessel to write clear and legible answers to a series of questions asked of him. However, the king of hell refused to cooperate and instead snatched the pen into midair so as to rapidly scrawl the answers himself. What the devil wrote was indecipherable, a series of diabolic scrawls that seem as though it should read from left to right. After being passed on to several learned men without success of decryption, the text disappeared into abeyance. As of today, no one has been able to decode the text or make a convincing case for it being a hoax. However, academics have identified traces of some of the manuscript's characters in Amharic, a language spoken in its purity in the province of Amhara, Ethiopia. According to legend, this was the primeval language spoken in the Garden of Eden.
It wasn't until recently that I'd even heard of the cryptid Ahul. In case it's new to you as well, it's a winged cryptid that some portray as a giant bat. Others claim it's a flying primate. Personally, I think it looks like a werewolf with bat wings. Whatever it is, we'll learn a bit more about the Ahul when Weird Darkness returns. We all want to live up to the legacy of our parents. Dr. Ernest Bartels was doing just that, but in an unexpected way. He was making his way through the jungles of 1925's Java Island, located in Indonesia, in search of the next great discovery. He had a great deal to live up to, being the son of noted ornithologist M.E.G. Bartels, who made a reputation for himself within the science world, having identified many previously unknown bird species. As for the young naturalist, Dr. Bartels had traded being in the classroom for the wilderness, and Java certainly had plenty of that. The island Java was the 13th largest island in the world, formed from the results of past volcanic activity. It was also the most populated island in the world, with 124 million people. Overpopulation was, unfortunately, beginning to have its effect on this Indonesian island. The rainforests that were once all-encompassing were beginning to dwindle. This was pushing extinction for much of the wildlife, which included 23 mammal species, over 200 bird species, and 500 forms of plant life. These figures do not include species at the time still undocumented. Dr. Bartels was in a race against time to fully study the animals of the region before they disappeared forever. Part of this research would also lead to his own hopeful wildlife discoveries and a place in the history books alongside his father. So, teamed with local guides and a notebook, he made his way through the most remote parts of the island. One of the many trails within his trek was with one of his most trusted guides from the local village, where together they ventured to a waterfall on the slopes of Salik Mountains. It promised to provide everything that he had been hoping for. The journey had been exhausting, but the view of the cascading waterfall crashing into a pool of water below was spectacular. At the site, the naturalist retrieved his book from his pack to take notes on the flora and fauna present around him. He was so focused on his work that he failed to notice the sound at first. It was a howling noise that started off low but gradually increased with intensity.
The village guides heard it immediately and began looking around nervously for the source of the sound somewhere within the trees above them. A howl came ringing from above them. It was so loud and clear that it completely drowned out the sounds of rushing water from the waterfall. Suddenly, a large, winged creature leaped down from among the highest branches of the rainforest canopy to come plummeting toward the ground below. At the last possible second, it unfolded two enormous wings from its body to divert its crash and launch itself into the air. They were 12 feet wide and enabled the creature to soar directly over Dr. Bartell's head before it followed the waterfall's course over the rocks and disappeared. The entire experience only lasted for a moment before Dr. Bartell's lost sight of it. The shock left him too stunned to respond, but he could still hear its call as it flew away. He was in utter surprise and set to inquire with the villagers as to what the creature was. It was unlike anything he had seen before, and he was obsessed with learning all he could about it. The villagers were very informed about the creature they called the Ahul, named after its call, a long Ahul. The creature was bat-like, described as the size of a one-year-old child with a gigantic wingspan of 12 feet. This is twice the wingspan of the largest known bat in the world, the common flying fox. Its dark gray fur was noticeably short. It possessed large, black eyes, flattened forearms that supported its leathery, red-skinned wings, and a monkey-like head with a flattish, humanoid face comprised with protruding fangs. Villagers usually encountered it squatting on the forest floor, at which time the Ahul's wings were closed, pressed against the creature's body, with its feet appearing to point backwards. The villagers reported that the Ahul was a nocturnal creature. The creature's days were spent concealed in caves located behind or beneath waterfalls. Its nights were spent skimming across rivers in search of large fish, using the claws on their abnormal feet to capture and devour their prey. Java Island contains numerous volcanoes and some amazing cave systems. These unexplored resources would be the perfect home for a creature or a whole family of giant bats such as the Ahul. As the creature appeared to be very territorial, it never traveled far from these caves or the rivers surrounding them. Dr. Bartels spent the next 2 years continuing his research and exploration. The Ahul became his quest and opportunity for recognition in the field of natural science. He made great progress while traversing every aspect of the island in hopes of documenting his discoveries. He was able to find a vast collection of Java's animal species to catalog. However, the Ahul continued to remain elusive, despite the tales of encounters from the villagers. He was beginning to believe that his encounter was set to become a once-in-a-lifetime experience. It was 1927 when he had taken up residence in a village close to the Zhijinkol River in western Java. The house was not fancy, but he had formed a close connection to the people and the land during his expedition. One of his favorite pastimes occurred during the late hours when he would relax in the darkness and listen to the sounds of the nearby jungle. After his years studying the wildlife, it was a simple, personal game for him to match the animal to the night calls that he would hear from time to time. One night, around nearly 11:30 p.m., he heard a vastly different sound just as he was about to drift off to sleep. It was a flapping sound heard above him. It was obvious to the naturalist expert that it was exceptionally large, but unlike anything that he had identified before. Suddenly, there was a heavy thud caused by the landing of the creature, which was immediately followed by the clear cry of the distinctive Ahul. Dr. Bartels was in disbelief. After searching for so long, the creature found him. He was on his feet immediately and grabbed the flashlight he kept close by. As he burst open the front door and ran out of his hut, the creature had already taken off. He raced off in almost complete darkness toward the direction the sound was coming from. The naturalist stopped on the path to catch his breath while constantly monitoring the skies for the winged creature. At first, there was nothing but stillness and darkness. Less than 20 seconds later, he heard it again, a final Ahul, which floated back toward him from a considerable distance downstream. any attempt to follow the Ahul along the dark waters of the river was impossible. Dr. Bartels had been so close to catching sight of the creature again, but it was gone. As he would recall many years later, he had focused on the sound not because he did not know what produced it, but rather because he did. The Ahul. This was the last experience Dr. Bartels would have with the Ahul, as he eventually ended his research in Java to return to academia, where he published his research. At the time, Bartels had suggested that the creature was not a bat, but some type of bird, specifically an exceptionally large owl. But his theory did not set well with his peers. Instead, he was greeted with enthusiastic denials by his friends, who assured him plainly that the evidence he presented was that of a bat, regardless of the size. Dr. Bartels' accounts of the Ahul made the rounds of academics, and eventually they were passed on to cryptozoologist Ivan T. Sanderson by Bernard Heuvelmans. Sanderson took a special interest in the Ahul because he, too, had met with such a creature, but not in Java. His encounter took place in the Asumbo Mountains of Cameroon, located in western Africa. The cryptozoologist thought that the Ahul could be an Asian form of the giant bat-like creature he witnessed in Africa, known by the African natives as the Congomato. Research regarding the Ahul continued long after Dr. Bartels and Sanderson's investigations. Some researchers have suggested that the creature may be a surviving population of pterosaur, a flying reptile thought to have gone extinct around the time of the dinosaurs some 65 million years ago. The description of the Ahul does match what science currently knows about the pterosaur species, including large forearms supporting leathery wings. Many investigators seem to agree, however, that the Ahul is more likely a form of unknown giant bat, looking to the creature's reported facial features as evidence against the flying reptile theory. A third, less popular theory, also based on the reported facial features of the Ahul, is that this beast may be the world's first reported case of a flying primate. As the population of Java continues to grow and the rainforest dwindles, the territorial creature could be rediscovered at any time or disappear due to deforestation, the latter of which would be a tragedy to the natural world and science everywhere. Thanks for listening. If you missed any part of tonight's show, or if you'd like to hear it again, you can subscribe to the podcast in your favorite podcast app by searching for Weird Darkness. Not only will you hear a copy of tonight's show, you'll also receive daily episodes of the Weird Darkness podcast. You'll find me wherever you listen to podcasts, even on YouTube. You can follow the show on social media by visiting the contact social page at WeirdDarkness.com. And please tell others about the show who love the paranormal or strange stories, true crime, monsters, or unsolved mysteries like you do. Doing that helps make it possible for me to keep doing the show. If you'd like to be a part of the show, you can send in your own paranormal experiences by clicking on Tell Your Story at WeirdDarkness.com. While there, you can also find my other podcasts like Retro Radio, Old Time Radio in the Dark, Church of the Undead, and a classic 1950s sci-fi style podcast called Auditory Anthology. All stories in Weird Darkness are purported to be true unless stated otherwise, and you can find links to the stories or the authors in the show notes, which I've already posted to the Weird Darkness website. Diabolical Dealings with the Devil is by Laura for Paranormal Scholar, and Cry of the Ahul is by Gary Brandt for Paranormality Magazine. Weird Darkness is a production and trademark of Marler House Productions. Copyright Weird Darkness. Now that we're coming out of the dark, I'll leave you with a little light. Mark 12, verse 30. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. And a final thought. Train your mind and heart to see the good in everything. There's always something to be thankful for. I'm Darren Marlar. Thanks for joining me in the Weird Darkness. Hey Weirdos, keep listening. Hour 2 of the Weird Darkness radio show is coming up. most people believe in some form of heaven and hell. They believe that if they are good people, they will go to heaven. If they are sinners, they will go to hell. Others believe that heaven and hell are just stories told on television and in movies. Some people honestly admit they simply just don't know if heaven and hell exist. Regardless of your beliefs, though, there are real places on Earth that look as though they could be the entrance to fiery pits of purgatory. Some people who have explored these various places on Earth believe they have truly found secret entrances that lead to the underworld. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Welcome, Weirdos. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness Radio, where every week you'll find stories of the paranormal, supernatural, legends, lore, the strange and bizarre, crime, conspiracy, mysterious, macabre, unsolved, and unexplained. Coming up this hour, of course, a lot of people likely don't believe in heaven or hell, and many will dismiss such things as mythical tales or folklore. However, there are places on Earth that could be considered hell. No, not Detroit or Wichita. We're talking about actual places that look like the entrances to purgatory. And perhaps they really are. If you're new here, welcome to the show. If you're already a member of our Weirdo family, please take a moment and invite someone else to listen in with you. Recommending Weird Darkness to others helps make it possible for me to keep doing the show. And while you're listening, be sure to visit WeirdDarkness.com and click on Contact Social to follow Weird Darkness on social media. And also on the website, you can find the daily Weird Darkness podcast, which comes out 7 days per week, along with my other podcasts. You can enter contests, find Weird Darkness merchandise, and more. You can even send in your own true story of something paranormal that has happened to you or someone you know. You can find it all at WeirdDarkness.com. Now, bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and come with me into the Weird Darkness. There was a place located in the southernmost tip of the Greek mainland, and some believe it is actually the gateway to hell. It is known as Cape Tanner, situated on the end of the peninsula known as the Manny Cave. They open up at sea level into a cliff. The area is marked by the ruins of a Spartan temple, and several entrances exist that the ancient Greeks say was the entrance to Hades Cave. Many Greeks believe that this is the place where Hercules began digging into the caves to enter the underworld. Hades was known as the god of the dead, and this area is linked to those beliefs. There are plenty of cave networks in this area. Within the ruins are the remains of a temple that was said to be a temple dedicated to the sea god Poseidon. The ruins are located on a hill directly above the cave to Hades. In the area, there's also a statue of the poet Arion. He escaped from pirates by being carried ashore by a pod of dolphins. The statue is bronze, and it resembles the poet riding a dolphin that stands at the crest of the cape far from the ruins of a temple that was raised in honor of the sea god Poseidon. The caverns below contain stalactites and stalagmites, and they can be seen below water level. You can visit the caverns by boat, and you can pass through the Gate of Hell. Fengdu Ghost City, China. This city is nearly 2,000 years old. It's located on the Ming Mountain in Fengdu City. The area is also known as the City of Ghosts, and it's located in Chongqing Municipality. It is believed that this is the place where the dead make a stop before moving on to the afterlife. It's said that this is where you go while you are waiting to find out if you're moving to heaven or hell. In the area are many Buddhist and Taoist temples.
Legend says that these temples are surrounded by immortal spirits that torment the souls of the dead. When a freshly dead soul arrives at the City of Ghosts, they must cross a bridge where their soul is judged for its virtue. If it is found that the soul is not virtuous, it will be tormented by the immortal spirits that haunt the area. If you want to test your virtue, the King of Hell in China will be there to determine whether or not you are virtuous. There is a very popular tourist area for people traveling on cruises through the length of the Yangtze River. In 1994, work in this area caused the water level to rise. That caused the City of Ghosts to become an island. According to the legend, two individuals lived during the Han Dynasty. Their names were Yang Changchen and Wang Feng Ping. They both quit their jobs at the imperial court and moved to Ming Mountain. There, they practiced self-cultivation in accordance with the teachings of Taoism. As a result, the two men achieved immortality. The men's last names are said to translate to the King of Hell. St. Patrick's Purgatory is located on a small island in the middle of an Irish lake. According to legend, the area dates back to the 5th century. Christ himself showed St. Patrick a cave that's often referred to as a pit on Station Island that was the entrance to hell. It is a place where souls wait before being sent to heaven. Christ directed Patrick to a cave on the island. During his stay, he received visions of the torments of hell so that justice could be created. The area is known to be a place where unworthy souls will be cursed and punished. The pagans in Ireland believe that this is a place where the devil actually exists. St. Patrick's Purgatory consists of holy wells and other sites. The area was once a pilgrimage spot. However, it was shut down due to an increasing number of serious incidents that were occurring there. There are areas that are still open to the public, and many people use Purgatory and its legend as an excuse to get drunk.
More suspected gates to hell when Weird Darkness returns.
I'm Darren Marlar. Welcome back to Weird Darkness. If you like what you're hearing and you'd like to hear even more, you can check out the free audiobooks that I've narrated at WeirdDarkness.com. I've got free audiobooks there by Algernon Blackwood, Edgar Allan Poe, Stephen King, H.P. Lovecraft, Charles Dickens, Robert Heinlein, Robert Louis Stevenson, and more. You can listen to all of the free audiobooks that I've narrated on the audiobooks page at WeirdDarkness.com. We continue now with Real Suspected Gates to Hell. The Gates of Guinea is said to be the entrance of the voodoo of the underworld. The gates are located in New Orleans through the seven gates that are scattered throughout the French Quarter. According to the voodoo legend, the souls of the dead reside in a part of the underworld known as Guinea. This is not a place where torture or punishments are handed out. It's actually a murky plain where spirits must pass before they can reach the deep waters, which is the area where they would be reunited with their family. The area is presided over by Baron Samedi. He's a skeleton corpse that is painted and dressed in a top hat and tails. He is a symbol of death and rebirth. The actual theories of the area vary based on the voodoo practitioner you're talking to. Many see the seven gates as a metaphor for the 7 days after death. It is believed that the soul will remain close to the body for the first week. This is the time where there is a great risk of the body becoming a zombie thanks to hoodoo magicians. During the 7 days, the soul will pass through each one of the gates to finally be met by Baron Samedi. Then, the soul will be taken to the land of the dead. There are other practitioners in New Orleans
who claim that the seven gates are located in various cemeteries scattered around Canal Street in the French Quarter. The gates must be opened in the right order during seven nights when seven moons are above. Also, proper respect must be paid to each guardian before entering each gate. The Hauska Castle has a terrifying background, and it is said to be haunted. It is one of the world's gateways to hell, and it has a very scary urban legend attached to it. The castle is 762 years old. It is a Gothic castle. It is said to have been built in order to seal up the real-life entrance to hell. It's believed to have been built between 1253 and 1278 and is located in the Czech countryside. Legend says the location of the castle was chosen so that it could cover the bottomless pit where the demonic creatures would enter our world when the sun would go down. These creatures are believed to be black-winged creatures that were half-animal and half-human. At night, villagers would be too scared to leave their homes and go anywhere near the hole. Even during daylight hours, people would avoid the area. Before the castle was built, this is the area where prisoners were sentenced to death and they would be sent here. Legend says that they'd be tossed into the pit for their punishment. If the prisoner were able to get out of the pit alive, they would be forgiven and set free. But that didn't happen very often. There was one legendary story about the first man who was ever lowered into the pit. The second that he was out of view of the people above, they pulled him out of the darkness. When pulled up, he had already aged 30 years after only a few seconds, and his hair had turned white. People say the demonic creatures from the hole would walk the town during the night, and they would drag people to the bottomless pit. Finally, the fear became too much for the villagers, and they decided to build the Hauska Castle to close up the hole forever. When the castle was built, people who were visiting the lower floors claimed to have heard the creatures from hell scratching on the floor, trying to find their way out. The Royal Air Force Station, Menwith Hill. If you look at this area from above, you would think that you were at a giant golf course, because there are structures in the area that look like huge golf balls. The area, which is located in the UK, actually belongs to the National Security Agency, or NSA. The NSA has been around much longer than people think. For a while, it was a secret. People didn't find out about the agency until Edward Snowden leaked the information about the secret government organization. It was actually established by President Truman in 1952. Many people believe that all of the NSA buildings are stationed in the United States, but they're wrong. This place is supposed to be a secret, but with such strange structures, it's hard to keep the place a secret. The place has been used by the United States since the 1950s. It looks like an Air Force base, but it's not. Originally, there were four golf ball structures in the area. Today, there are over 30, and there are pieces of high-tech satellite equipment that can gather and intercept communications. This is not a place the public can visit. The U.S. military is stationed here, and they will not let you in, and they won't talk about their jobs. They won't tell anyone what they do there. The base is known as the American Death Star. It's said to be carrying out all types of illegal spying, and there are plenty of crazy stories and theories about this place. We may never know the truth about any of it. One of those crazy theories is that they are guarding an entryway to hell. The Bohemian Grove is hidden in the ancient redwood forest in Northern California. It was originally built as a camp for the most powerful and rich men in the world. Since 1923, every U.S. Republican president has been an exclusive member of this camp. Nixon, Reagan, Eisenhower, and both Bushes have been to this place, which has a lot of history behind it. There are plenty of stories surrounding the area, and the biggest one involved the Manhattan Project, a secret operation that was planned back in 1942, and it was the code name for the operation that created the atomic bomb. This is a place where the rich and the powerful gather in what's like a summer camp. There are also some pretty strange things in the grove, such as a 40-foot owl statue that has something to do with a secret ceremony that takes place on the first night that everyone arrives. The ceremony begins with everyone wearing dark hoods as a small boat crosses the artificial lake that is located in front of the huge owl. The leaders of the group pretend to offer a human effigy that comes from ferrymen of the boat, which they set on fire at the foot of the shrine. While all of this is taking place, a scary voice comes from the speakers that are hidden in the statue. Next, fireworks go off, and the ritual is over. Conspiracy theorists have a lot to say about the area. At one point, Alex Jones and his cameraman snuck in to see the ceremony, and they filmed the entire thing. He made a documentary with this footage, and he called it The Dark Secrets Inside the Bohemian Grove. Bureau 39. These days, North Korea is in the news quite often. North Korea is known as the Hermit Kingdom because the leaders have cut themselves off from the rest of the world using threats and intimidation. Due to these cut ties, there are plenty of mysteries surrounding North Korea, and not much is known about the place because the leaders keep everything tightly controlled. North Koreans have one television channel to watch, and they're shown constant propaganda. The people of North Korea are not allowed to hear about what's going on in the rest of the world unless it is sanctioned by their government. They're also not allowed to speak about what their everyday lives are like to anyone living outside the country. Anyone who is caught talking can wind up in labor camps along with their entire family. In severe cases, they can face execution. Because everything is a secret, people wonder about Bureau 39, also known as Room 39. The organization was founded in the 70s. According to many, it is a place where the state's money is laundered through some very classified accounts in Switzerland and China. These rumors have never been proven due to the sanctions that are set. Since the country needs some type of income and they avoid trade with the rest of the world, it's believed that they make money through fraudulent transactions such as drug trafficking and arms smuggling. The North Korean government will never admit that this is happening, of course, and they will never admit that Bureau 39 even exists. Nobody knows where the place is located, but they do say that there is a printing press capable of printing counterfeit U.S. money. Since we literally know nothing about the area, there is no way of knowing if the rumors are true or if it even exists. Since the government does have money and they're not involved in any trade embargoes with any other country in the world, there is a good chance that Room 39 does exist. Area 51 is a United Air Force base that is highly classified, and it is a detachment of Edwards Air Force Base. It's located in Nevada, in the Nevada Test and Training Range. The purpose of this base has an amazing story behind it, partially due to the fact that the U.S. government denied its existence until 2013. For several decades, the government claimed the area didn't even exist. Although the government was denying its existence, people were still talking. It's believed that an alien craft crashed into the desert of Nevada, and the U.S. government found it. People say that they have the alien's body and its aircraft stored there, and they have been studying it for years. This is part of the reason that UFO enthusiasts make it a point to visit Area 51, or as close as they can get to it. To make the place more mysterious, the people who work there are not allowed to talk about what they do, even to their family members. The people who work there aren't even allowed to talk to their co-workers about what they do. In a typical work setting, you know exactly what your co-workers do every day. That's not the case in Area 51. Two people who work in adjoining offices don't even know what their neighbors do all day. This just goes to show you how mysterious the dealings at Area 51 actually are. When the government is so secret about something, there certainly is something to hide. They may say that they're working on high-tech aircraft, but most people don't believe it. And a small faction of people believe they're dealing with demonic forces.
Welcome back to Weird Darkness. I'm Darren Marlar. Coming up, why are some people suddenly vigorous, alert, and feeling much better shortly before they pass away? It's something that's happened since time began, but medical experts are still baffled by it. But first, a king, a gossoon, and a bear walked into a bar. No, this is not the first line of a joke, but a common occurrence in Potrero Hill in San Francisco, California during the 1880s. Here's the story. Frank McManus's kingdom was Irish Hill, a 10-square-block area between 20th and 22nd Streets and Illinois Street and Pier 70 in Potrero Hill. Irish Hill was aptly named, with the vast majority of its inhabitants born in the Emerald Isle. 6 feet tall and 230 pounds, Frank earned his crown by becoming the master of politics, drinking, and fighting, three of the major Irish arts. In those days, drinking and fighting were both a pastime and an entertainment. On Saturdays, instead of going to a music hall, the patrons of one saloon would fight the patrons of a different saloon in a roped-off area. After the fights, the victors would buy the losers a nickel beer in their saloon. As the owners of the Union Boarding House, which included a saloon, Frank provided beds, drinks, and jobs for hundreds of workers at the Union Iron Works and Pacific Rolling Mills. In exchange, they gave them their money and votes. Frank was often accompanied by an entourage of 10 to 20 brawlers ready to do his bidding. With the ability to deliver up to 1,000 votes, Frank became a major power broker in the Republican Party. He soon brought his family over from Ireland to help him rule his kingdom. His favorite was his younger brother Cornelius, Con for short, who he named the Gossoon, an Irish term for a youth. As king of the Potrero, Frank McManus held himself above the law of the common people. He was often arrested for drunkenness, fighting, and attempted murder, but he always got the charges dismissed, either through fear or political power. He would plead guilty for using bad language and pay a $10 fine. Instead of a jester, Frank had a 300-pound black bear chained in his backyard as part of his retinue. The bear participated in the numerous drinking bouts at the royal court. After one of these bouts, the besotted bear ripped his chain loose, wandered into the second floor of a nearby rooming house, and got into bed with a man who was similarly soused. The man, thinking his friends were joking with him, started hitting the bear until the bear returned the favor. Suddenly, the man awoke and realized the bear was not a hallucination and started screaming. His screams woke the rooming house, and the bear was returned to the king without causing any serious injuries. Around 1890, Jack Welch and his brothers, fellow Irishmen who had honed their political skills in the rough-and-tumble world of Tammany Hall politics, arrived in the Potrero. Jack and his brothers opened a boarding house around the corner from Frank's place. Jack, who was a Democrat, attached a large group of men who had been chafing under Frank's rule. Thus began the Blue Mud Wars, named after the blue rocks that would turn to mud during the fighting. This war was won during the bloody 1891 primary when the Welch faction decisively defeated the McManuses, and the Democrats won the day. More than 100 men were involved in the fighting that day. King Frank, however, refused to accept defeat, and a war of attrition followed. On June 2, 1892, Frank and his followers dragged Jack out of the carriage he was riding in on 3rd Street. Con McManus stabbed Welch, and Welch pulled out his pistol and shot Con 3 times. Though seriously wounded, both men survived. On June 14, 1894, fellow ballplayer Charles Sweeney was attacked by Con in a 3rd Street saloon. During the fracas, Sweeney shot the gossoon 3 times, killing McManus. The death of his brother drove Frank wild. He tried to get into Sweeney's hospital room to kill him and had to be restrained by 6 policemen. When the priest refused to perform a high mass during Con's funeral services,
Frank threw a brick through the church's window and threatened the priest's life. Despite testimony that Kahn had been the aggressor, Sweeney was convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 8 years in prison. The death of his brother devastated Frank and caused him to increase his already Herculean drinking. Within 2 years, he had wasted away to 130 pounds and died of congestive heart failure. Irish Hill disappeared after World War I, when industrialists bought the hill to expand their businesses. The hill was leveled and dumped into the bay. Terminal lucidity is a puzzling phenomenon that has been known since ancient times, but it's only recently that scientists have started to pay attention to this unusual condition that could shed new light on near-death experiences and unravel some of the many mysteries of human consciousness. Terminal lucidity occurs to only a small percentage of people, but recorded cases show that it's still plenty we don't know about the human brain. Those who are in the terminal stage of the disease experience often, shortly before dying, suddenly show unexpected, visible signs of health improvement. People who should be dying are instead full of energy and strength. This is terminal lucidity, and this condition lasts from a couple of weeks to just a couple of minutes before death. Relatives who have seen their loved ones recover shortly before death with their memory being intact have been shocked. Why people suddenly experience mental clarity and memory just before passing away is still unknown. The term terminal lucidity was coined in 2009 by Dr. Michael Naum, a biologist who also works at the Institute for Frontier Areas of Psychology and Mental Health in Freiburg, Germany. Being curious about unexplained riddles about life, Dr. Naum started to investigate an unusual biological phenomenon that he later called terminal lucidity. Today, his findings have become an interest to other scientists. Doctors who observed this peculiar condition in dying patients have been surprised because it doesn't make any sense, and yet it is real. In many of the recorded cases, it should be impossible for patients whose brains were destroyed by tumors and Alzheimer's disease to return to ordinary intellectual activities. Dr. Naum says there are several astonishing examples of terminal lucidity. For example, he recalls a 91-year-old woman who suffered from Alzheimer's. The sick woman who had been cared for by her daughter couldn't recognize anyone for the last 5 years of her life. All family members, friends, and people she previously knew were complete strangers to her. Then, suddenly one evening, she behaved like a healthy human being again. She had a normal conversation with her daughter and revealed her fears of death. The old woman explained what problems she had with her other family members in the past, and everything seemed fine, almost like a miracle. Sadly, she died a few hours later. Her sudden improvement in health and mental abilities is a perfect example of terminal lucidity. Anna Katharina Emmer, a German woman who lived from 1895 to 1922, is another curious case that has baffled scientists. Anna was born with several mental disabilities, and she spent all her life in an institution. She couldn't speak a single word, gorged her food, and fouled herself day and night. Her behavior changed on the day she died from tuberculosis. Dr. Wilhelm Wittenben and Friedrich Happich, a Protestant theologian, were stunned when they saw what Anna was suddenly doing. "When we entered the room together, we did not believe our eyes and ears. Emmer, who had never spoken a single word, sang dying songs to herself. Specifically, she sang over and over again, 'Where does the soul find its home, its peace? Peace, peace, heavenly peace.' For half an hour, she sang. Her face, up to then so stultified, was transfigured and spiritualized. Then she quietly passed away. Like myself and the nurse who had cared for her, Dr. Wittenben had tears in his eyes," Happich recalled. Dr. Nam and Bruce Grayson from the University of Virginia said that Anna's story represents one of the most intriguing cases of the phenomenon. According to Dr. Nam, about 42% of all people who had flashbacks died on the same day. How can sick people gain mental clarity just before they die? Why do patients who suffer from Alzheimer's disease, brain tumors, or stroke suddenly, for a brief period, exhibit normal behavior? Terminal lucidity is currently a medical mystery, and one of those anomalies that neuroscience cannot explain. At least, not yet.
When Weird Darkness returns, many say the most haunted hotel is the one in Colorado that was used in the film The Shining. There is evidence that one in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, though, deals with even more paranormal activity. We'll look at the Crescent Hotel up next. I'm Darren Marlar. Welcome back to Weird Darkness. If you'd like to stay up to date on everything that we do here with Weird Darkness, read original paranormal articles by yours truly, register for contests or more, you can sign up for the email newsletter. You can sign up for the Weird Darkness newsletter for free at weirddarkness.com/newsletter.
In Eureka Springs, Arkansas, overlooking a valley, sits the Crescent Hotel and Spa. Opening its doors on May 20, 1886, it began its rich and haunted history, which eventually gave it its nickname of America's Most Haunted Hotel. Designed by Isaac L. Taylor and built by the Eureka Springs Improvement Company, headed by the governor of Arkansas, Powell Clayton, in hopes of taking advantage of the springs surrounding the hotel that were touted as healing waters, stonemasons from Ireland were brought in for construction and brought the 78-room resort to life, boasting numerous towers, chandeliers, beautiful gardens, and wooden pathways. People flocked to the Crescent Hotel, but when they realized that the springs held no healing power, they stopped coming and the hotel closed its doors. It reopened and ran as the Crescent Women's College and Conservatory from 1908 to 1924, but when tuition couldn't maintain the cost, they closed it again. In 1937, the Crescent reopened, this time as a cancer center run by a man named Norman Baker, who advertised a miracle elixir that cured cancer. Sadly, he was a fraud, gaining $4 million from his unsuspecting victims and ending in his arrest in 1937. From 1940 to 1946, the building sat empty. In 1944, four businessmen bought it and restored it, but in 1967 a fire destroyed most of the fourth floor. It passed through many owners until May 1997, when Marty and Elise Roenig bought it, restoring it to its former glory. In September 2002, renovations were finished. With such a rich and sometimes sordid history, it's not surprising to find some ghostly activity. With the smell of pipe tobacco, orbs, and the appearances of pools of blood, the haunted history of the Crescent is already ripe with paranormal activity, and that is without the full-bodied apparitions. The most notorious ghost is that of a womanizing Irish stonemason named Michael, who allegedly fell through the roof into room 218 during construction, hitting his head and killing him instantly. Loud thuds today can be heard, and sometimes his apparition appears in the room staring at the floor. He's also been blamed for ghost hands reaching out of the mirrors, orbs, and blood on the wall. Theodora is another ghost. She was a cancer patient and one of the victims of Norman Baker, who has appeared in full body apparition in room 419. Another ghost is that of a young woman who lived there while the building was a college. She was either pushed or jumped to her death. She often wakes guests as they sleep by touching them, and her apparition has been seen. Sometimes her screams can be heard as she falls, reenacting her death. There is also the ghost of a man dressed in hat and tails that is thought to be the ghost of Dr. John Fremont Ellis, a frequent visitor of the hotel. Another apparition dressed in a top hat with a full beard has also been seen. The ghost of Norman Baker, the con artist, is usually at fault for moving objects and loud footsteps. Also, the apparitions of two nurses have been seen pushing empty wheelchairs or carrying clipboards. There is also the apparition of a waiter carrying butter through the dining room, as well as the ghosts of a bride and groom, which appear in a mirror, but not in the dining room itself. There have also been sightings of a little boy and a little girl. So if you're seeking ghosts, this would be the place you're most likely to find them, and for those brave enough, they do offer daily ghost tours. With all the paranormal activity, the Crescent earns its nickname as America's most haunted hotel. Baba Vanga, born Vangelia Pandeva Dimitrova, was an extraordinary mystic and clairvoyant from Bulgaria who gained international recognition for her alleged prophetic abilities. Born on January 31, 1911, in Strumica, a small village in the Ottoman Empire, her life unfolded against the backdrop of tumultuous historical events. Despite being blind from a young age, Baba Vanga's remarkable insights into the future captured the imagination of millions worldwide. This long-form biography delves into the life, predictions, and enduring legacy of the enigmatic seer known as Baba Vanga. Vangelia Dimitrova's early life was marked by tragedy and adversity. At the age of 12, she lost her sight due to a tornado that swept through her village. However, it was during this traumatic event that she claimed to have experienced her first supernatural vision, which she interpreted as a divine gift. Word of her prophetic abilities spread, and soon people from all walks of life sought her counsel. Baba Vanga, as she became known, had the ability to see into the future, predict natural disasters, and provide detailed insights into individuals' lives. Her accuracy in foretelling events became legendary, and her reputation as a seer continued to grow. Throughout her life, Baba Vanga made numerous predictions that have both fascinated and perplexed people. Some of her most famous and accurate prophecies include the assassination of John F. Kennedy. It's believed that Baba Vanga accurately predicted the assassination of the American president in 1963, stating that an American brother would be killed by steel birds. The fall of the Twin Towers. Baba Vanga reportedly predicted the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center in New York on September 11, 2001. She described a vision of steel birds crashing into two tall brothers. Brexit and the European Union. Baba Vanga allegedly predicted the United Kingdom's decision to leave the European Union. According to some accounts, she claimed that Europe would no longer exist as we know it by 2016. And the rise of Vladimir Putin. Baba Vanga purportedly foresaw the ascent of the Russian president to power and predicted that he would bring about significant changes in his country. These are just a few examples of the many predictions attributed to Baba Vanga, which have sparked both skepticism and awe among believers and skeptics alike. Baba Vanga's prophetic abilities remain a subject of debate. Skeptics argue that many of her predictions were either vague or open to interpretation, and that any apparent accuracy could be attributed to coincidence. However, her supporters claim that she possessed an extraordinary gift, allowing her to tap into realms beyond our comprehension. Baba Vanga herself remained humble about her abilities, often stating that she was merely a vessel through which divine knowledge flowed. She believed that her purpose was to provide guidance and comfort to those in need,
rather than seek personal fame or fortune. Baba Vanga passed away on August 11, 1996, leaving behind a legacy that continues to captivate and intrigue. Her predictions, though sometimes met with skepticism, continue to generate curiosity and speculation. Her life story and alleged abilities have been the subject of books, documentaries, and countless articles. Furthermore, her home in Bulgaria has become a pilgrimage site for believers who seek spiritual solace and hope. The house has been turned into a museum dedicated to her life, where visitors can learn about her predictions, examine personal belongings, and gain insight into the world of the blind mystic. Baba Vanga, the blind Bulgarian seer, left an indelible mark on the world with her alleged prophetic abilities. While opinions regarding the authenticity of her predictions remain divided, there's no denying the fascination and intrigue she continues to evoke. Her life story serves as a testament to the enduring power of belief and the human fascination with the mysteries of the future. Baba Vanga's enigmatic persona and her uncanny ability to peer into the unknown will undoubtedly continue to captivate the minds of generations to come. Thanks for listening. If you missed any part of tonight's show or if you want to hear it again, you can subscribe to the podcast in your favorite podcast app by searching for Weird Darkness. Not only will you hear a copy of tonight's show, you'll also receive daily episodes of the Weird Darkness podcast. You'll find me wherever you listen to podcasts, even YouTube. You can follow the show on social media by visiting the Contact Social page at WeirdDarkness.com. And please tell others about the show who love the paranormal or strange stories, true crime, monsters, or unsolved mysteries like you do. Doing that helps make it possible for me to keep doing the show. If you'd like to be a part of the show, you can send in your own paranormal experience by clicking on Tell Your Story at WeirdDarkness.com. All stories in Weird Darkness are purported to be true unless stated otherwise, and you can find links to the stories or the authors in the show notes, which I have already posted to the Weird Darkness website. Baba Vanga is from Paranormality Magazine. Secret Doors to the Underworld is from Factsverse. King of the Irish Hill is by Paul Drexler for Crime Traveler. Terminal Lucidity Phenomenon is by Cynthia McKenzie for Message to Eagle. And The Crescent Hotel was written by Amanda Penn for Vocal Media Horror. Weird Darkness is a production and trademark of Marler House Productions. Copyright Weird Darkness. And now that we're coming out of the dark, I'll leave you with a little light. Psalm 128, verse 2. You will eat the fruit of your labor. Blessings and prosperity will be yours. And a final thought, the key to living a good life is recognizing that there are no doors, no confines, no origin or destination. There is only the journey. Cindy Dale. I'm Darren Marlar. Thanks for joining me in the Weird Darkness. Don't go anywhere, weirdos, because Sudden Death Over Time is up next. Sudden Death Over Time! Sudden Death Over Time! Weird Darkness! On September 23rd, 1935, in the Kingsbury Run area of Cleveland, Ohio, two male bodies were found in the bushes. Someone had beheaded and emasculated both of them. The police arrived and conducted a preliminary investigation, during which they found both heads. One of the bodies bore additional evidence of chemical treatment which turned the skin leathery and red. This was the beginning of the Cleveland Torso Murders, the work of one of the most heinous and brutal serial killers in U.S. history, also known as the Mad Butcher. There was no blood at the scene, and this led detectives to conclude that someone committed the murders elsewhere and transported the bodies to the site. One of the bodies remained unidentified, but the other body was that of Edward Andrassy, who the police already knew as a petty criminal. Q
Curiously, police determined that the other anonymous man died several weeks before Andrassy. Police work began in earnest, and the workload increased when the body of a female showed up in January 1936. Her murder had occurred in a similar manner as the two men. It was surprising to the detectives that the killer had changed the gender of his victims, which was unusual. Someone soon identified the body as Flo Palillo, a frequent patron of bars in the area. At this point, the famous Elliot Ness became involved, as he was Cleveland's chief of public safety. He added himself to the growing number of law enforcement working on the case. In June 1936, a male body surfaced that featured six notable tattoos strewn across his body. Police displayed the morgue reports and the victim's death mask at the Great Lakes Exposition that year to thousands of people. However, not a single person knew the tattooed man. His identity is still unknown today. In September, a partial body lay with a hat nearby that authorities later identified as one given to a homeless man by a local woman. This reinforced the theory that the Cleveland torso murders involved only people from the lowest rungs of society. There was a slight lull in the murders. Although the investigation continued at a frantic pace, the Mad Butcher of Kingsbury Run remained at large. Cleveland's serial killer apparently took six more lives before the last canonical victim emerged in August of 1938. Like Jack the Ripper, there was some disagreement among law enforcement as to the number of murders the Mad Butcher committed, and he had surgically decapitated all of them. The Kingsbury Run shantytown emerged as a result of the 30s Great Depression. During this time, many people lost their jobs and suffered major economic hardships, especially immigrants and minorities. Vacant areas within the industrial zone of Kingsbury Run provided homeless and downtrodden individuals a place to set up makeshift residences. A number of the Cleveland murders surfaced in the Kingsbury Run shantytown. In 1938, Elliot Ness headed the raids of Kingsbury Run. He evicted about 300 individuals and burned down roughly 100 shanty homes. The hunt for the murderer hit one dead end after another. Investigators were hopeful when they identified a man named Frank Dolezal, who frequented a bar that several of the victims also patronized. People described him as prone to anger and threatening when drunk. Police took Dolezal into custody, and after some time, he confessed to one murder. Unfortunately, he hanged himself before they fully questioned him about the other murders. Suspiciously, after his death, his autopsy revealed several broken ribs, which acquaintances of the man said he didn't have when police took him into custody. This led the press and general populace to believe his confession was worthless because it appeared that police had obtained it under physical force. Later, Ness himself oversaw the pursuit of Dr. Francis E. Sweeney, who had served as a military doctor in World War I. During his time in the war, he conducted amputations of wounded soldiers. He later developed mental illness. Police brought him in, and the doctor failed a lie detector test. Ness felt he was finally on the path to the killer and continued to press the medical man. Unfortunately, Francis Sweeney was related to the U.S. Representative Martin Sweeney, which complicated matters for Ness. The suspect voluntarily committed himself to a mental institution, which placed him out of legal reach of Ness and his team. Had Ness pursued the doctor further, the doctor had an insanity defense virtually locked in place. Coincidentally, the Cleveland torso murders appeared to stop after the doctor went into the mental hospital. Cleveland police continued to investigate the crimes. However, they made no convictions, and the murders remain a cold case today. Perhaps with new evidence or technology, police may solve these murders in the future, or they may remain a puzzle from the realm of 20th century true crime. An ice storm, the flu, and a computer virus have kept me out of the blogosphere for a while. When it rains, it pours, and in this case, it rains ice. But one good thing came out of trekking twice a day to the only outlet still serving food. About 2 days into the storm, one of my fellow refugees approached me during dinner with a very strange story. Adam Myers of Kansas, Oklahoma, another in a long line of creative Okie names, had an encounter of the slithery kind in the summer of 2005. Kansas, Oklahoma is a small town in Delaware County, just off the Cherokee Turnpike. It has a population of 685, according to the last census. Myers said, "I was riding my four-wheeler at dusk behind my uncle's house where there's a lot of trees. Back behind his house, there is a dip that leads to a pond that he also owns, and before you reach the pond, there is a turnaround point." It was dusk, and Myers began to get spooked. He continues, "I turned around, and right at the dip, my four-wheeler immediately shuts off. I'm trying to pull start it, and I started getting a little more freaked out because I heard some rustling off to the side. I look over and see a human-like shadow standing off to the side, but instead of being a normal human, he had a snake-like head." The being approached Myers, who struggled more and more frantically to start his vehicle. "I gave one final pull on the starter while pressing on the gas at the same time, and my four-wheeler starts, and I haul out of there and go tell my friend Joe what I seen." Joe took the four-wheeler and returned to the site, but headed back to the house after hearing a noise that did not seem normal. The most interesting thing about Myers' snake-headed humanoid is the resemblance it bears to the Seminole tribe's human snakes, legendary malevolent creatures that lived in dens full of giant snakes. I asked Myers if he was familiar with the legend, and he said he was not. Human snakes are either half-snake, half-human, or can shapeshift between the two. Human snakes aren't the only breed of strange snake the Native Americans believe in. The Cherokee tribe tells of Eucana, a giant horned reptile that lives in the water, and perhaps most interesting are the creek's Thai snakes, strong, dark snakes that live in caves alongside riverbanks and are capable of pulling unsuspecting humans to a watery death. Of the 46 species of known snake native to Oklahoma, only a few are aquatic, and none are powerful enough to prey on humans. The western diamond-backed rattlesnake and the coach whip hold the title of Oklahoma's largest snakes, both clocking in just shy of 7 feet long. But could there be monsters hiding in the forests and lakes as the native legends hold? Snake Creek, near Ten Killer Lake, appears to have been named for a good reason. Edna Stubblefield recalls in the Stubblefield memoirs that sometime in the 1890s, she and her family spotted a snake at the creek that looked like a big old fence post crawling across the road. A 9-foot Burmese python turned up in a Tulsa driveway, and on October 25, 2001, another Burmese python, this one 7 feet long, appeared in the Stillwater neighborhood. While we're on the subject of out-of-place reptiles, how about rampaging alligators? The official range of the American alligator is restricted to extreme southeastern Oklahoma, particularly Choctaw and McCurtain counties, and yet they seem to keep turning up in other parts of the state. In August 2002, a South American caiman, of all things, was netted in Lake Tenkiller. Another caiman, this one 2 to 4 feet long, appeared in a Tulsa backyard in February 2004. And in July 2006, animal control officers spent 2 days trying to capture a 4-foot-long alligator that appeared in the Battle Creek Golf Course in Tulsa. The gator was never caught and apparently vanished. Note of interest, the Battle Creek Housing Addition was also home to another out-of-place creature in 2005. A mountain lion reportedly terrorized the neighborhood, preying on household pets. It, too, was never caught and eventually just faded away. And then, of course, the strange case of the fugitive gator. In the summer of 2003, a 350-pound reptile dubbed the truck-traveling alligator was caught in a pond, sent to a breeder, and then sent to Safari Joe's, a wildlife sanctuary in Adair. The gator promptly vanished from its pen and reappeared in a pond just south of Interstate 44, and then turned up in yet another pond, this one behind the Big Cabin Truck Plaza, where he was finally recaptured. He was relocated to prime gator habitat in McCurtain County. Granted, giant reptiles are nothing new to Oklahoma. The Sam Noble Museum in Norman hosts the world's largest apatosaurus, 93 feet long, found in the Panhandle. And if that's not big enough for you, the world's largest dinosaur to date also once called Oklahoma home. In 1994, fossils that were first thought to be tree trunks were discovered. The trunks turned out to be the neck bones, each 4 feet long. The sauropod the bones belonged to stood an estimated 60 feet and weighed 60 tons and was dubbed Sauroposeidon, the earthquake god lizard. This monster went extinct 110 million years ago, but perhaps some of the god lizard's smaller cousins stuck around.
Sudden death over time.
We're dark.